Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Kroeger. Dr. Kroeger is of the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Disease. This is one of the centers of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Kroeger's in Anchorage. He's going to be addressing provider and patient reluctance to both providers and our audience today regarding immunization. So if you've got questions or comments about anything to do with immunizations, you got one of the national experts here that you can ask questions about, so don't hesitate to do that. You can reach us in Anchorage by calling 550-8433, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our regular listeners should know you can email us at line one. You got to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line one at kska.org. Dr. Kroeger, welcome to Line One.
Thank you very much, Thad. It's great to be here.
All the way from Atlanta, just in time for winter. All right. Well, hopefully the weather will stay halfway decent while you're here. So we're going to be talking about immunizations and trying to put it in the proper perspective. I almost tried to say the best perspective, but the issue is putting it in the proper perspective and making sure people can understand and respect the national policies that we have in place. But let's start with the idea of what a vaccine or an immunization does. How does that work in lay terms?
So what a vaccine does is it kind of mimics a natural disease process caused by a microbe. So when you administer a vaccine to someone, you're giving them a dose of what we call an antigen, which is a component of the microbe. That then allows a person to develop what's called an antibody response. They produce proteins. We call these things antibodies. And with these antibodies, a person is subsequently able to mount a response. These antibodies attack the antigen contained in the vaccine, and then they also generate what we call immune memory, a memory response, which allows the person to remain protected from that microbe and future infections with the microbe. So that in a nutshell is kind of how they work. Vaccines have been one of the most important interventions, actually, that we have had in public health to prevent various diseases. You know, we've eradicated smallpox. We've eliminated from the United States measles, polio, rubella. So they're quite a successful public health intervention.
And I recently did a little commentary on smallpox, I guess it was, on KTUU. And I got into the history, and it turns out, I mean, various attempts at something like immunization have been around for quite a long time. It never really got formalized until in this last century, but so the idea is not a new one. And in a sense, as I hear you describe it, it's really we're maybe the word's not true fooling, but we're fooling the immune system of an animal, in this case ourselves, into thinking we've had an infection, which normally would give us lifelong immunity without all the risks of the illness.
Exactly. You said it in a nutshell. The natural disease causes the strongest immune response, but of course there are negative consequences to having disease, and we take those off the table when we give a vaccine dose, because of course vaccines are made in such a way and that they're safe and they don't cause the same symptoms of natural disease.
Why would any country see it as an important thing to do to immunize its population against what it could immunize it against?
Because vaccines work. I mean, we've eradicated smallpox. That doesn't threaten anyone in the world anymore, and we credit that to the smallpox vaccine. We no longer see measles. You know, measles used to cause 500,000 cases a year, and that was an estimate. It probably was actually much higher. Everyone got measles disease in the U.S. before this vaccine. 500 deaths a year due to measles before this vaccine was licensed. Rubella, of course, is a public health threat in that it can cause diseases in the newborn, congenital infections. Polio caused around 20,000 paralytic cases a year during years in which there were epidemics. And with those three diseases, measles, rubella, polio, we've eliminated them from the United States. We don't see indigenous measles, rubella, or polio, and that is because of vaccines. So prevention of vaccine-preventable diseases.
Besides the fairly obvious benefit health-wise in preventing death and morbidity and other medical issues, do most countries look at it also from a cost-effectiveness basis? That is, that we have less people not working, and you know, so there's some overall economic benefit to a country. Is that a factor in these decisions as well?
That is definitely a factor in the United States. The recommendations for the use of vaccines are made by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we do that based on guidance from what's known as the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. That is an organization that consists of 15 non-governmental vaccination experts. There's experts from academia, people that work in academic medicine. There are laypersons as well on the ACIP. One of their charges is to develop recommendations for CDC, give us guidance. And they do that on the basis of not only the science and the and whether the vaccines work and whether they're safe, but they also do look at cost effectiveness. It's part of their mandate. So that is an important thing that the United States does, is determines, you know, how much will be saved through the use of vaccination. There is an economic part of it, definitely.
It's not a reasonable question to ask what I'm about to ask, and that is, how effective are they? And the reason that, to me, is not a fair question, really, is because each vaccine has a little different efficacy. But in general, how effective are our current vaccines? What is an example of one of our best and an example of one of our worst? And I think I know what you're going to tell me about worst, and then we'll talk about why that one's such a difficult one, maybe.
The range is always going to be somewhere between 60 and 100% for vaccines in terms of efficacy. Some of the better vaccines are the live vaccines because, as we mentioned, natural disease produces a strong, long-lasting immune response. So the more a vaccine mimics the actual live microbe, the stronger it will be and the better it will be. And so the live vaccines, we can generally count on, for instance, the measles component of MMR, 90 to 100% efficacy. Mumps component, maybe 80 to 100% efficacy. And that's with the first dose. And of course, we recommend follow-up doses. So the live vaccines are the best. Many of the inactivated vaccines have efficacies in the 80%. So they don't, none of them are 100%, of course, but they all, they generally have good efficacy. Some of the non-routine vaccines that we have, such as the typhoid vaccine, efficacy is a little bit lower for travel vaccines. And that's generally, you know, more acceptable in the context of the risk of disease being so high. And plus, added to that, the fact that we don't recommend travel vaccines routinely for everybody.
Another issue we should perhaps define and address, or at least comment on the significance of, is this idea of herd immunity, because that is a critical component in the overall success of preventing illnesses we're trying to prevent. Is that true, and why is that, and what is herd immunity?
Right. So herd immunity is the concept of protecting someone with a vaccine when they do not receive the vaccine themselves. As you've mentioned, no vaccine is 100% effective. Likewise, not everyone can actually receive a dose of vaccine if it's recommended. If a person has certain medical conditions, those conditions might be contraindications for a vaccine, meaning that that person should not receive a dose of that vaccine. So there are people that can't receive the vaccines. And so by preventing the disease in someone else, these diseases, of course, are communicable. People spread the microbes from to other people. We therefore protect the community, the herd, as it might be. We like to use the word community immunity instead of herd immunity. Herd immunity is kind of going out of vogue. But
yeah, it's got some connotations that you don't need, right?
So giving a vaccine dose to other individuals and providing protection that way is basically it conceptually. Okay. There's a lot of mathematical models that are used to determine, you know, which vaccines are the most effective in producing community immunity as well.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Kroeger. We're talking about reasons that the public and also providers might have regarding reluctance to provide recommended immunization. So if you've got questions or comments about concerns or worries about immunizations or experiences that you feel like you'd like to share or have better explained, why don't you take the time and give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. We're going to be here till just about shortly before 3 o'clock. So if you've got some questions or comments, you're free to give us a call. An example that's somewhat like this community community immunity, as I keep struggling over the word herd immunity because that's what was present when I was back with the CDC, is the suggestion that all children this year be immunized from 6 months to 18 years with influenza. And partly that is to protect those people who do not get immunized from getting it from kids. Is that part of the theory there as well?
Absolutely. I'll jump in and say that we now this year recommend influenza vaccine for all persons 6 months and older. So okay. It's yeah. Children, adolescents, adults as well. But yes, the idea there is that because we know that children between 5 and 14 years of age, there are some studies that come from the 1970s, which are still valid today, because when you look at influenza disease, that hasn't really changed that much since the 1970s, shows that the highest rates of disease are in children 5 through 14 years of age. We have about a 30% attack rate. 30% of children in these ages will become infected.
One in every three.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we now recommend vaccinating all of these individuals, all of these children and persons of all ages greater than 6 months, so that they prevent transmission. They may not be at the highest risk of severe disease and the complications of disease, but it's very likely that they will spread it to someone else. So again, we give the vaccine to that person and then maybe someone who is older that may have a contraindication and is at risk of disease will be protected by their contacts being immunized.
Let's. We have a couple of callers on the line. I want to go ahead and take the first one. Meg, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have the HPV virus. And a few years ago, I went in, they diagnosed me with it and said, okay, there's a few pieces that we need to take out. So they took a few pieces out. It hasn't reoccurred since. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and my gynecologist has told me not to get her the HPV virus or the vaccination because she told me that no one really knows what it is. It works, but they don't have any more information on that. So I'm concerned about whether or not to give it to my daughter.
All right. That is a great question. And when you say you've got part of it, you're talking about you've had a cervical infection with that virus. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I have the HPV, but it's never gone into the cancer.
Okay, yeah.
It's never stepped further than them going in and taking a few pieces out. And even with that, they told me this may hurt your chances of having children, and that's scary.
Right.
So I obviously want my daughter to be able to avoid that, but at the same time, I'm scared to give her this vaccination that my gynecologist isn't even sure about.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's exactly why this program is hopefully going to be helpful. Andrew, how do we answer this?
Well, I can start by talking a bit about what the vaccine is, I guess. or maybe a bit about the virus itself. Human papillomavirus is a virus that is very common. There are 6 million new infections every year. It is sexually transmitted. It is a cause of cervical cancer. So it and certain strains of the virus are the specific strains that cause cervical cancer. What the vaccine is it's a part of the a part of the surface of that virus. It is not the entire virus itself. It's a part of the surface of the virus. And so, as we've been kind of talking about, it generates an antibody response. So it is produced in a lab. It is, but it uses components that very closely mimic the virus itself. It's kind of a very novel process of genetic engineering to make this virus. But that's what it is. It's an inactivated vaccine. It is recommended universally because really everyone's at risk. Most infections occur in younger people. And it is recommended for everyone 11 through 26 years of age. It's actually licensed down to 9 years of age. CDC recommends it for all females within those age groups. It can also be given to males because males are also at risk of acquisition of this virus, although they're not at risk of cervical cancer, obviously.
Right.
But it does transmit. And we don't really have to go into, I don't think, issues of sexuality per se, because the goal of any vaccine is to give it before the risk happens, right? Vaccines
exactly.
are preventive tools. You give it, you give them while people don't have the disease and before they're at risk, and they generate the immune memory. So those are the ages for whom it's recommended. It's been studied. It's a very safe vaccine. A lot of outcomes have been specifically studied for this vaccine because it's a new one. You hear a lot about things in the media, specific outcomes. They have been looked at in a controlled fashion. And so it is a very safe vaccine. It's also a very, very effective vaccine. It's one of the few vaccines that has been really determined to be 100% effective if it is given early enough, if it's given before someone actually is infected with the virus.
She's not active yet,
right.
And that's
right.
My main concern is the fact that she's not active, and if I should go ahead and do this, it's like you said.
Right.
It's a perfect time before. So it is really the perfect time to vaccinate. If it's, again, the age of recommendation is 11 through 26, but of course it's licensed from 9 through 26, so providers can give it to girls, women as young as 9 years of age.
Having a national expert on the show, I mean, that I just thought, bam, I'm calling.
Well, I think there, yeah.
I listen every day, so thank you so much.
Yeah, and I think there's also this concern by parents that why would it be given so early when kids are probably not sexually active, and the issues, that's the whole point, is to do it, because we also know, if I'm not mistaken, that most women are going to pick up this virus, maybe not the strain that causes cervical cancer, but we don't know which one they're going to get very quickly once they become sexually active. This is the same virus that causes common warts. It's everywhere, so it's hard to avoid not getting it.
And that's it. I didn't get the warts, and then I went in and I had the sign of the cervical cancer, which is even scarier that you don't have any signs.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's true of 16 and 18 of the HPV strains that do this. They don't cause warts, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. 16 and 18 cause.
So you won't have any symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and I'll just throw it out for safety, for maybe to help you with this. I have two daughters in this age group that are both vaccinated completely. So I think it's a very safe and appropriate thing to do.
I think I'm going to go on and do it, and you guys were very informative. Thank you so much.
All right, you bet.
Yeah,
you bet.
Thank you.
I can add on to that, too, as well, that we recommend the vaccine 11 through 26 years of age, regardless of history as well of disease, because you may not know which strain specifically you are. So people that have had HPV infection already will still be recommended to receive this vaccine.
So that's new, because I have older daughters who I did exactly the same, but even older than 26, who I would argue should probably go ahead and get the vaccine anyway, because they don't know whether they're going to, although it's outside the recommended age, because it's not been studied in that age group to be effective. Is that the primary reason?
Well, epidemiologically and statistically, acquisition does occur in high numbers. We're talking 40% of women older than 30 have been infected with type 16, which is the one most commonly implicated for cervical cancer. So because of that, manufacturers didn't really look at that age group. And they've started to now, and they're not really seeing a lot of efficacy with this vaccine. So it's not licensed for that age group. But in a given one-on-one circumstance, patient provider, of course it can be given if, you know, there's an indication for
it. So this is another one where it helps to talk with a physician. For example, if that patient has never been sexually active, is 33, then it would be a reasonable thing to consider.
Yep, it would be. We always tell providers it's off-label, but it definitely makes a lot of sense.
And I've said this before, and it's getting harder and harder to buy into this, but off-label doesn't mean unethical or illegal. It just means we don't have safety and efficacy that the FDA has signed off on. It doesn't mean it may not work.
Correct.
Or be the right thing to do.
No, in fact, I mean, this one example that we've just been talking about is an example where CDC and the FDA are aligned. But actually, there are other circumstances where CDC will actually make a recommendation that goes beyond what the FDA says. So because of the medical evidence that shows it's the right thing to do, even with lack of FDA data. So
good. They're good. Chris, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I had a question about the chickenpox vaccine. About a 40-year-old, I've never had the vaccine, and I've never had chickenpox. I'm wondering, what are the risks between getting the vaccine and side effects, as opposed to just taking the do-nothing approach?
So basically, when you're looking at the risk-benefit ratio for someone that is considered at risk for chickenpox disease, no question that that person should receive the vaccine. Chickenpox is often thought of as a benign disease, but before the vaccine was licensed, we actually would see 20 deaths, more than that actually, more like 100 deaths a year from chickenpox. So there are complications that can develop. People that are older are at higher risk. The vaccine is a live vaccine, but it's what we call attenuated. It has been weakened, so it cannot cause the same symptoms of the actual disease. Now, I am going to kind of step outside the risk-benefit calculation for a minute, because you've mentioned your age, and technically we define a cutoff for what we call presumptive immunity / susceptibility. And we say that persons that were born before 1980 are in fact considered immune for the purposes of vaccines. So someone that's 40 years old may in fact not be specifically recommended to receive this vaccine. There are exceptions to that age-based cutoff. If someone is a healthcare provider, we would say that they should receive a dose of the vaccine. If someone is born outside of the United States, because all of that's based on patterns of disease in terms of determining that age-based cutoff. But for persons born in the United States that are born after, rather before 1980, that person is considered immune and probably, even if they don't remember it, has had the disease and therefore doesn't need the vaccine. It wouldn't hurt to get it if it would just boost an immune response that's already there based on the natural disease that occurred in the past. So in a sense, in your particular case, it might not be necessary, but it certainly wouldn't hurt you to get it. And if you're in the health professions, then you do need to get it. Why the health professions? I guess I should explain that. I mean, we also, again, take transmission into account, and someone that's in the health professions will be in contact with a lot of people that are vulnerable to chickenpox. Chickenpox can cause complications, hemorrhagic varicella in patients that are immunosuppressed. So any provider in contact with these types of patients needs to have this vaccine.
Okay. Well, that's good news for me then.
I got distracted with an email. Did we talk about the fact that he could get a serology to see if he's ever had chickenpox? Was that brought up?
It wasn't, but that's a great question. I mean, that comes up a lot, and that is an option. It's not always our favorite option for many circumstances, but for someone that has never had a dose of vaccine, the serologic tests that are out there are pretty good at telling you whether you're immune or susceptible. So that would be an option. It gets a little tricky when someone has already had doses of the vaccine. And I don't want to get too complicated, but there are different types of cells that protect you when you're immune. And the tests that are out there measure antibody levels. And when you receive a dose of vaccine, you are protected because not only because you have high antibody levels, but also because you have high levels of other cells that are important for long-term memory. But after the vaccine, I mentioned vaccines are weakened, the antibody levels actually drop. And so you still have that long-term protection. You are indeed protected against future disease, but you can't measure the antibodies. So what happens when people that are vaccinated and they're asked if they can be tested after they receive the vaccine, you're going to get a negative result. It's going to look like
a false negative.
A false negative. Right. They're actually protected and don't need a dose, but the test says they do, and that can create a vicious cycle whereby people get vaccinated and tested and vaccinated and tested. But if you've never had a dose of the vaccine, the tests are pretty good at looking at immunity and susceptibility.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Chris, thanks for your call. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us by calling 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1, L-I-N-E, at O-N-E, at KSKA.org. And after this short break, we're going to continue to take calls and listen to or take some emails and talk with Dr. Andrew Kroger on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Dr. Andrew Kroger, who's a physician with the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Disease of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. And we're discussing reasons that providers and patients might have reluctance to provide immunizations to themselves or their relatives. So if you've got questions or comments, you can email to line1 at kska.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433, 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 between 7 and 8 p.m. at night, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast, and we won't be here to take your questions. Dr. Kroger, here's an email that asks a couple of questions. And one is, in some people, there seems to be an antagonism towards immunizations due to a desire to follow a religious doctrine, that there may be in these individuals a lack of respect for science and trying to secure the information on their own. That's the first question, and let's address that. How would you address those concerns or that reluctance, reason for reluctance?
I think in any context where you're trying to communicate issues of vaccine safety or vaccine efficacy or even vaccination in general as a practice, you need to communicate in a culturally sensitive way and use the, you know, the language and the terms used by patients. So this is kind of my message to providers. So many heads of religions have actually kind of come out in favor of vaccines. They've looked at, I know the Vatican in the past has said it's okay to vaccinate with the MMR vaccine because there are some religious sensitivities about the use of these vaccines. Certain vaccines have components in them as well that might be ruled out by a religion because of dietary considerations of the religions. And but yet many people that profess those religions still, you know, become vaccinated themselves. So there's information on our website which kind of address these concerns. I think just providers have to do their best to communicate in a way that the patient will understand and accept. And providers also have to be prepared for the patient that's going to simply refuse, that is going to happen. And that's where the message would be to the provider, I guess, to be culturally sensitive, but do your best to communicate that these vaccines are life-saving, not only for the – it can be life-saving, not only for the vaccinee, but for the person or the other people around them as well. It's a selfless act to get vaccinated, and I think it's an important thing to do.
Okay. The second question on this email is, could some parents – are others in charge of another person's health believe that they, having the ultimate responsibility, should err on the side of letting nature have its way regarding whether to immunize or not?
Well, I mean, vaccines are a tool that we use in medicine. I mean, again, there are going to be people that reject medicine flat out, and it's tough to tell providers what they can do in that circumstance. But I mean, vaccines are a tool like antibiotics, like, you know, other life-saving equipment that's used in medicine, ventilators, you know, except vaccines are used while a person is healthy to prevent future illness. These diseases are out there. So, and they're not benign diseases. They can cause death and will cause death. So why not prevent it with the tools that we have? These vaccines are safe. So to me, it seems like a decision that should be made. I mean, the vaccine should be the decision in that circumstance.
Okay.
But you're not going to be able to convince everybody. You
right.
just can't.
Right, right. All right, let's take a couple more calls. Heather, you're on line one.
Yeah, I was listening when you were talking about the varicella vaccine. And you said it's a live vaccine, attenuated, and I think that's what you said.
Yep.
Anyways, and you said that you can't catch it from the vaccine, which is untrue. My friend's son caught it from, he got chickenpox from the vaccine. And I just wanted you to address the people that actually do get very ill from vaccines and are very adversely affected by them, which happens probably as much as the actual disease happens these days, probably percentage-wise.
Well, I'll let Dr. Kroeger answer that.
So 10% of recipients that receive varicella vaccine will have a rash, and the rash will consist of the same types of lesions that we see with chickenpox disease. And as you put it, it is a mimicking of the disease. It's a live virus vaccine, and you can recover vaccine virus from those lesions. But it is it's a choice of risk benefit. The natural varicella virus is still out there. I like to think that
my son had chickenpox. I did a slower schedule for him than the recommended, and he ended up getting chickenpox.
So, right, people that are incompletely vaccinated as well can also be infected with the wild virus that's out there. with the actual natural disease virus. So we recommend a dose at no earlier than 12 months of age, and then one at kindergarten, 4 to 6 years of age. There's always going to be a risk-benefit calculation as time goes on, as we see fewer and fewer cases of natural chickenpox. The two will start to kind of come together in that sense. But the varicella vaccine is a safe vaccine. Again, we don't know of any serious complications or severe complications that have come about from the use of this vaccine in particular. But yeah, it is going to create in some people lesions that mimic the natural disease, but they're almost invariably going to be milder.
Can you catch chickenpox from someone who is vaccinated like you can catch it from the natural disease?
Yes, it is possible. If a person has a rash after the vaccine, they can spread that vaccine virus to other people. And we do make a specific recommendation that if someone is vaccinated and then they come in contact with someone that is immunocompromised, and if that person that's immunocompromised is susceptible as well, because the immunocompromised person might be immune to chickenpox, in which case there's no risk. But if that immunocompromised person is susceptible, then yes, there is the possibility of that type of transition. And that is a risk that we accept when we make our recommendations for the use of this vaccine. Again, the idea is to generate enough immunity so that this is not an issue. Transmission from natural or vaccine virus. So, yeah, these are kind of the risk-benefit decisions that are made.
Can I chime in on something else? So my son was exposed to a person, an elder, who had shingles, and that's the only thing. I mean, he was that's the only person he was around. So I'm curious that if it, it doesn't seem like it can be eradicated, because I don't know that you can eradicate shingles. You know, it seems like it's something that isn't going to, it's a natural disease that isn't going to be like mumps or rubella or something that you can pretty much get rid of.
So your question is the vaccine ever going to be effective at decreasing the frequency of chickenpox?
Yeah, because my son got it from an elder who had shingles.
Yeah.
He wasn't around any kids who had any chickenpox.
Okay.
So shingles is the reactivation of the same virus that causes chickenpox. People that have had chickenpox in the past, 3 to 4 decades later, may develop the disease called shingles, in which the vaccine virus reactivates. It creates a rash that looks similar to the chickenpox rash, with the exception that in most people it's a localized rash. And so it is possible for this virus, the chickenpox virus, the varicella virus, to be transmitted from someone with shingles, but it's unlikely, because usually someone with shingles is covering their rash. Unless it's a very sick person that's immunosuppressed themselves and they develop shingles, they could have more generalized shingles. That's easier to transmit it to other people, but it does seem less likely. On the point of eradication, if we do get to the point where we eliminate from the United States and then eradicate from the world the disease chickenpox, then 30 to 40 years from that point, we will effectively have eradicated shingles. We won't see the reactivation disease, we think. We're still, when you give a live virus vaccine, again, there is the possibility that that live virus vaccine could become latent. And again, we have seen cases of reactivation disease, a localized chickenpox-like shingles rash that contained varicella vaccine virus. But in all cases, those were mild cases, not comparable at all to the disease shingles, which is intensely painful. Shingles has been described as, it's been described in so many different ways, so many different types of pain. It's been described as a kind of a neuropathic, like the slightest touch of a feather on the skin causes an excruciating burn-like pain. It's also been described as a very visceral type of pain, similar to the pain of childbirth or passing a kidney stone. That's what we see with natural shingles disease. We have not seen that with the very rare cases of shingles from varicella vaccine virus. So eradication of shingles, natural shingles, I think is something that we should all be looking forward to. I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's quite a painful disease that also now is preventable.
Well, great. Well, thank you for answering my questions. I'll let somebody else come in.
All right. Thanks for your call, Heather. I was going to ask Heather. I think she made the comment that she had said that the frequency of problems, and I'm paraphrasing her, with the vaccine is equal to that of the natural disease. And I certainly wanted to get to that, and I think we should address it because I think that is appears to me to be a horrible misconception.
Well, it's a misconception at certain points in time for the use of a vaccine. I mean, the natural cycle of vaccine usage is that the vaccine begins to reduce cases of natural disease. And ideally, at some point in time, as we move on the path to elimination of disease, we will see more side effects from the vaccine. Then we will see natural
right.
disease. So
right.
we're not really there with most of the vaccines that we recommend routinely.
Yeah. I'm not sure
we're not there
what,
with chickenpox.
Yeah, I wasn't sure that's where she was getting at, but I mean that's what drove the change from oral polio to the killed injectable vaccine is that suddenly we didn't have any wild virus. So why should we take except one in a million cases of vaccine associated? Illness, right?
And right. In this country, we don't.
So now we use the kill stuff, which can't do that.
Right.
So yeah, and that's the point you're making. That at some point, risk benefit ratios do sometimes require some changes in policy.
Changes in policies, changes in the vaccine, and eradication elimination comes before stopping use of the vaccine, and that's another important point. So, but yes, we all have to be prepared as providers and patients to deal with. Adverse reactions that can occur following these vaccines when we've done such a great job of preventing the disease, we don't see the diseases anymore for the most part.
This is just I think, a comment from an email. As a school board member from 1975, 1981, I authored and promoted the mandatory immunization of polio and MMR for all children entering the Anchorage School District. Over time, I've seen this requirement watered down. Exemption for loud for reasons that seemed based more on personal opinion than legitimate and sometimes in parentheses religious reasons. Judgmental though it sounds, I find those parents who did not immunize their children to be irresponsible and even selfish, allowing their children to expose others when they become sick. Please comment.
It's been disturbing. The rates of exemptions that we've been seeing there, they're still low overall. I mean, but in some states there are exemption rates as high as 3%, and some of those exemptions are medical exemptions. But then we've been seeing a rise in what are called the religious exemptions or philosophical exemptions to vaccination, and it's a problem. I mean, we're seeing outbreaks now that we think are due to exemption rates. The measles outbreaks that we witnessed 2 years ago in California were in pockets of unvaccinated individuals and unvaccinated because of these philosophic or personal belief. I think we use the term personal belief exemptions now instead of philosophic. So personal belief exemptions are what cause those outbreaks to occur. I mean, for a disease like measles, it's so highly communicable that you only need a few cases to really allow widespread transmission among all of the people that are susceptible. So, and if you have a bunch of people that are susceptible, that's when you see these clusters occurring in these pockets of personal belief exemptors. So yeah, we're seeing outbreaks as a result of this, and it is a big problem, and people should look beyond themselves when we talk about vaccination.
Jean, you're on line one.
Well, I'm walking right into this. I'm old enough to remember before most vaccinations were out, and I just wanted to make some comments on it. tears, it curls my hair to see people avoiding vaccination when I can remember, for one thing, very apropos of the conversation, getting chickenpox when I was 16. And after puberty, chickenpox is not anything anyone can really stand. And watching, being quarantined from school because my brother's little brother had measles, and watching my mother struggling with whooping cough when she had three kids under five, being terrified because she looked like she was going to strangle to death. She was coughing so hard. And taking all of this for granted because that's the way it was. You got all these diseases, and there wasn't anything anybody could do about it. And so it really bothers me when people say, well, there's no point. I'd rather have the disease than the vaccination. And that's all. Just a comment.
Well, I think that's, in a sense, that's a big issue, is that there are even physicians who have not seen measles and German measles and pretty soon chickenpox. These vaccines are effective, and there is a consequence of that. And so we have a whole group of parents now who don't appreciate the danger. And as you said, you think these illnesses are bad in kids. Wait till you get to be a teenager and adult. You're not going to forget these illnesses if you don't have serious. But Andrew, this is your chance to talk. I just
no. I mean, I'll just echo the same. I have not seen measles. I have not seen rubella. I've seen chickenpox.
You're too young.
But my response is kind of a visceral one. Like it's like something alien to me. So that pushes me towards vaccinating. Mm-hmm. And I guess the challenge is to kind of communicate that feeling and that concept to other providers, you know, that this is something definitely worth preventing. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about the diseases enough, I don't think. I think that's part of it is everyone's pressed for time, and medical health educators are no different. And
there's a wonderful book I've used quotes from called the Polio Chronicles, where they've actually gone back and interviewed adults, and they have vivid recollections of suddenly waking up, not being able to walk, and what they went through with respirators. So that information is out there too for people who really want to get a feel for what these illnesses were really like.
And we are given reminders. We're seeing pertussis now, clusters.
I want to get to that very question. Gene, thanks very much for calling.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye. So, I have a question. Why is it such a bad idea to delay infant immunizations with the idea that we might get towards one of those immunizations that are recommended very early? And there's an example going on in California right now as to why that's important.
Yeah, we recommend vaccines specifically at those ages when people are at highest risk of the disease or the complications of the disease. And so that is infancy for the vast majority of vaccine-preventable diseases. It's somewhat dependent on the type of vaccine we use. With live vaccines like measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, infants also are at risk for those diseases. Fortunately, they're protected from their natural maternally transmitted antibodies. They don't need the vaccine. But they are at risk in infancy and for a host of other diseases, and I'll talk about pertussis. Pertussis is a disease for which the infant is at highest risk. It's a bacterial disease. It causes destruction of the lining of the throat, the respiratory tract that leads to the lungs. Infants that are infected with this bacterium can what they're doing literally is they're coughing and choking to death. And they become hypoxic due to lack of oxygen, and they can become encephalopathic. They can have neurologic symptoms and can die. And they are recommended to receive vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months of age in infancy, another dose at 12 months of age, and then one before starting school. It's called the diphtheria tetanus acellular pertussis vaccine. That vaccine is recommended at the ages for which that child is at risk of disease, and likewise for a number of other diseases, hepatitis B, rotavirus, we have vaccines for all of these infants now to prevent disease at the time. You can't space out the doses. The way the vaccines work, of course, is with an inactivated product, it doesn't create a long-lasting response with just one dose. That's why we have multiple doses. So you can't space them out. You need them, you know, at those two-month intervals in order to generate a strong enough response to protect the infant.
And occasionally we have a natural experiment which reminds us that this is necessary. And in California right now, it's my understanding there is the biggest outbreak they've had in 30 or 40 years down there, mm-hmm. and 7 or 8 or 9 deaths, most of those in children less than 4 months of age or less, if I'm reading the information that I see correctly, which just goes to emphasize that's the highest risk age group for this illness. And it's whooping cough when we talk about pertussis.
Yes,
right.
Whooping cough. And the highest risk for the severe complications and death from pertussis. We've seen around 4,000 cases now in California, and it is their highest in highest caseload in several decades. Most of the cases are occurring in infants that are not supposed to receive the vaccine. There probably is some lack of vaccination as well. We don't know that for certain yet, why there's lack of vaccination, but I think there are, in some cases, they are infants that should have received doses of vaccine. And another important message here is the transmission and the community immunity concept is that we do have a vaccine now that can prevent disease in adolescents and adults. And what we're seeing as a result of these outbreaks is more attention being given to the adolescent/adult form of this vaccine. It also contains, in addition to the pertussis component, it contains the tetanus and the diphtheria component. So it's really a vaccine that is intended to substitute for one of the tetanus doses that all adults are supposed to receive, all adolescents and adults are supposed to receive on a 10-year cycle. Now we substitute and give them a dose of this vaccine that also contains the pertussis component. And we know that's necessary because we've learned something about this disease. We know that your immunity does wane over time. When the adult and adolescent vaccine was first licensed, it came on the heels of discovery of outbreaks that are occurring among adolescents of pertussis. So we know that disease does occur. The disease is not severe in adolescents and adults like it is in the youngest infants, but we can vaccinate them and prevent transmission to the young infants.
When you say immunization protectiveness wanes over time, you were specifically talking about pertussis. I want to hopefully make that clear because the vaccines in general have very good long-term immunity. Although I'd quickly point out, I was one of the first to get the polio vaccine, so we don't have lifetime records on any vaccine, really, because of that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But pertussis is an exception.
It's always ongoing.
Yeah, pertussis is really an exception. This is a difficult organism to generate an immune response to, even in the natural situation, is my thought. I mean, there's something about that organism that's unusual.
Right. We know that protection wanes over time following natural disease as well. Someone
right.
with a history of having
right.
had pertussis disease
right.
should also receive the vaccine when they become an adolescent and adult. So, there's a lot of antigens that were contained in the original whole cell vaccine, which just kind of demonstrates that this bacterium is packed with weapons, you know, the natural disease. And so I guess the antibody response wanes over time.
We only have about 4 minutes, and we really haven't asked the critical question I think that I would like to know is, what are the most common reasons parents are giving for not immunizing? And I know I haven't given you enough time now to respond to those, but you know, if you give them, I'm going to make the assumption, unless you want to talk more, that there's pretty good evidence that these are not valid reasons. And you know, if we have a valid reason, I need to know that too.
As far as why valid reasons why parents don't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think
Or what are the reasons that they give, most of which I'm assuming are not necessarily valid based on what we know, but there probably are some valid reasons as well.
I think fear of side effects is their number one reason that they give. I think that's it's natural. There's a high threshold for safety for this product. You give it to healthy people. It's not a medicine that you give to someone that's sick. It's something you give to a healthy person. So there's a very high threshold of safety. And fortunately, FDA and CDC have met that challenge. Safety surveillance is continually conducted, both before and after the vaccines are licensed. Obviously, the studies that are done before a vaccine is licensed looks at will detect common side effects if they exist. When they're found not to exist, the vaccine gets licensed. And then we continue to study afterwards, you know, to look for rare things. There's a constant process. It never ends. And so the vaccines that have stood the test of time have done so because they are safe. So that's the most, that's a very important thing, is the safety issue. Other reasons, parents, along the same lines, there's a lot of vaccines. So parents are worried about giving all of the vaccines. They think it's going to have some effect on the immune system in terms of using up antibodies. And I think basically the science demonstrates that that really is not the case. It, because of the way immune cells work, there are plenty of them in the bodies of all persons at all ages to generate an antibody response to millions of antigens. I mean, that's what we are. We're constantly exposed. That's probably the biggest reason. Perceiving the disease risk would be another major reason. And we're a victim of our own success. We have done a great job of reducing the amount of disease, so parents don't see the diseases anymore.
What do we know about side effects to most of these vaccines? What's the risk of serious side effects first?
Severe side effects such as an allergic or anaphylactic reaction to a vaccine, those are extremely rare. We're talking about one in a million. And that risk is lower than the risk of the serious complications from the disease. So it's always the right decision to give a dose of vaccine. And you can also screen ahead of time for an allergic reaction in a person. They're so rare that parents know about them. Parents know when they have their child has an allergy, so they can be screened for. And if there is an allergy, an anaphylactic allergy, wheezing, hives, then you know not to give the vaccine dose. So those are the severe ones. There are conditions like Guillain-Barré syndrome, also one in a million, very, very rare. Peripheral neuropathy can be severe, but again, less common than the complications from these diseases. You need to vaccinate to prevent the diseases.
Okay, so the bottom line is generally for most individuals, the safety weighs on the side of getting the vaccine versus not getting it. The risk of not getting it usually is a bigger risk. Is kind of the principle of all of this.
Absolutely. I mean, as an optimist, I'll say that the benefit of preventing these diseases and their complications, which can be fatal in many cases for some people, outweighs the benefit of withholding a dose of vaccine.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to spend with us here in Anchorage. So my thanks to Dr. Andrew Kroeger of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for addressing concerns that providers and patients may have on reluctance to immunize. Line 1 is going to return in 2 weeks, October 11th, with Anchorage specialist Dr. Laura Schultz. We'll be talking about the diagnosis, care, and treatment of children and adolescents with cancer in Alaska. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program and, believe it or not, did the phones as well. Thanks for listening, especially to those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.